Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute or so after 6 p.m. here on the East Coast, we've got 3 hours of conversation radio ahead of us. I am Bob Kincaid. And is it Thursday already? By Jove, it is. Listen, everybody, sorry about the screw-ups last night. That was probably as frustrating for you listening live as it was for me broadcasting live. What happened was, one of those we dance on the razor's edge of technology, and sometimes we get our little heels cut moments. For some reason or another, the internet around here sucked. And I think the fine folks at CityNet have gotten it all squared away. Those guys are great. If I haven't reminded you lately, it is the best internet technical support, I would hazard to say, in the country. And if you're anywhere within their coverage area, you can go to citynet.net and find out. If you're anywhere in their coverage area, give them a try for your telephone. You can save a bunch of bucks, really. And should you ever have a problem, they are Johnny on the spot. Sadly, they know me by name by now. Because we make technology do things that the technology itself was not intended to do. It may not be readily apparent, but we are in the making bricks without straw business, based on what we have to do just to get a show out every evening, no matter where that show is coming from, whether it is Guy James, Mark Levine, me, whether it's John Fox on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time with all Foxed up. All of it. Involves making technology do things that the technology was not intended to do. Yeah, nothing weird or kinky, just the next step beyond. And that certainly goes double for Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He has done little miracles every day since 2002. A reminder at the front end of the show, in case you turn off at the credits, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org is in need of a new computer. It is an expensive new computer, and he needs all the help he can get from you. WhiteRoseSociety.org, because what happens on his end has everything in the world to do with whether or not the programs that we do here and send from here and send from anywhere else get out to you. So please remember that. Meanwhile, back here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West Virginia, it's the 9th of April. We are a third of the way through, and we are not a third of the way to the $2,000 we try to raise every month. I know you're sick of hearing that, but let's just get that out there into the universe's little delicate shell-shaped ear, and maybe something good will happen. So there, you know, it's there. We stay behind the eight ball here. That's all there is to it. Now, into the meat of the program. And, of course, your phone calls are welcome, always. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on, H-E-A-D-O-N. If you want to save us some toll-free bucks, you can always reach us at 304-658-3333. And you can reach me at Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. I will try to get to your emails through the course of the program, because that's as much a part of the program as the phone calls. as is your participation in the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room. Plenty of room. Jump on in. It's a big load of fun. Yeah, that's another bill we've got to pay soon, and we've got to scratch up the scratch to do that with. The chat room ain't free, and that bill has come due for another year, and we're sort of sweating the run-up to being able to pay that. It's always sweat. Sweat. Anyway, if you recall from yesterday evening, a wonderful show yesterday, except for the fact that the Internet was not behaving itself. If you recall from yesterday's program, you will recall that we began the early part of the program with a little bit of audio. It was from this really squirrely, twisted, bigoted, sick group called the National Organization for Marriage. And they've got this terrifying ad that it's got, you know, they're taking away my freedom. You know, that kind of stuff. Just to refresh your recollection, okay?
There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark and the winds are strong.
And I am afraid.
Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have taken the issue far beyond same-sex couples.
They want to bring the issue into my life.
My freedom will be taken away.
I'm a California doctor who must choose between my faith and my job.
I'm part of a New Jersey church group punished by the government because we can't support same-sex marriage.
I'm a Massachusetts parent, helplessly watching public schools teach my son that gay marriage is okay.
But some who advocate for same-sex marriage have not been content with same-sex couples living as they wish.
Okay, so you remember, that's enough of that nonsense. Yeah. I'm scared of the gathering dark and gloom, you know. Jesus, honey, what were you potty trained at gunpoint? I mean, didn't mommy ever tell you that the dark's not really that scary, that it doesn't have monsters in it? So, oh, you poor thing. So anyway, that was the start of the program, and of course that involved, there was, and I didn't have time to dig it up, I was busy doing other things, but you may recall from yesterday that I was sort of getting a little cross-eyed and sideways, and, you know, that guy ain't from New Jersey, and that ain't no doctor. These are actors. Actors. Well, kudos, which incidentally is a singular word in Greek, I do believe. It turns out that the Human Rights Campaign, bless their hearts, tracked down the audition reels for this stupid little ad. And there is, about 14 minutes worth of people auditioning in front of a green screen to be in this scary gay people are going to get married ad. Okay? And rather than subject you to all 14 minutes, I just sort of did some time compression on it. And what we have here is the raw reel. I guess you'd call them the dailies in the moving picture biz. The dailies of the audition. And I thought you might like to hear it, just to save you the 14 minutes it would take to play all of it, because even 14 minutes of funny, unintendedly funny right-wing stupidity is trying. So I managed to cut it down to about a minute and a half, and you still get the same idea. So I thought you'd enjoy this.
I'm a California doctor who must choose between my faith and my job.
I'm a California doctor.
I'm a California doctor.
I am a California doctor.
I am a California doctor.
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 Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case loving you.
Cut!
I'm a Massachusetts parent, helplessly watching public schools teach my son that gay marriage is okay.
I'm a Massachusetts parent.
I'm a Massachusetts parent. Gay marriage is okay.
Oh, cut!
The storm is coming.
The storm is coming.
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 Ride in the storm out. Ride in the storm out. Ride in the storm.
Cut.
Coming together. Coming together.
Coming together.
Coming together.
Come together. Right now. Over me.
Son of a gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?
Son of a... Cut. So there you have it. In full, the compressed version of what it takes to put together a sick, fear-mongering, the right-wing, evil-gelical religion industry ad to try to terrify the... I don't know what percentage of this country is dumber than the doorknob, but to convince those that the gays are out to get your marriage. I have yet to figure out what this one woman means when she says...
Wait, I'm a California doctor.
No, not that one.
Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have taken the issue far beyond same-sex couples.
What the hell does that mean? I mean, it reminds you of Rick Mann on Dog Santorum, doesn't it? That's where it goes in my brain. Is that what it's supposed to do? Or this?
They want to bring the issue into my life.
My freedom will be taken away.
Please. Pick up the phone. Explain it to me. What freedom is taken away when people who love each other have rights extended to them? Oh, wait. That's code. That's right-wing evangelical code again. That's code for I won't be able to freely hate. But that really doesn't play so well. I can't hate him like I used to hate him. I ain't going to have the freedom to hate him. No, honey, you're just not going to have the freedom to... Oh, but never mind. I did this last night. Yeah, these are some real winners. I mean, it's hard to believe.
Same-sex couples.
The storm is coming, but we have hope. A rainbow coalition of people of every creed and color are coming together in love to protect marriage.
In love.
There's a storm gathering.
This could be speaking of Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum. For some reason or another, you know, we talked briefly last night about why it is that old-fashioned newspapers are going the way of the dodo. Maybe it has something to do with what the old-fashioned newspapers put in them. For example, 3 minutes ago I mentioned Rick Santorum. If you want to see the definition of the word Santorum, just Google it, and it's really icky and this. But he really is what he puts you in mind of. Maybe the reason newspapers are dying is because they're not fit. So many of them aren't fit to read anymore because of the long, unending, steady drumbeat of liberal media, liberal media, liberal media. They're liberals, you know, for reporting. A fire truck raced to the corner of South and Main today to put out a fire. Liberal media! Maybe that's got something to do with it. Maybe the reason newspapers are in trouble has something to do with papers like the Philadelphia Inquirer offering column inches to Rick Santorum to pen something called The Elephant in the Room, Obama versus the United States. What? It almost seems like the people who run for-profit media, wait a minute, they wouldn't be that cynical, would they? They wouldn't be that shameless, would they? The for-profit media, wait a minute, what's that old saying? If it bleeds, it leads. Oh, dear. No, the for-profit media wouldn't be so cynical as to try to participate in ginning up reactionary gunfire and slaughters and so. No, they wouldn't do that, no. Well, why then do they give column space to a nobody, a has-been, a wash-up, an ex-Republican senator who has absolutely no impact whatsoever on public policy, on the debate, whom the voters of Pennsylvania themselves utterly discredited and threw out of office. I mean, this is Rick Santorum. This is a guy whose wife tragically gave birth to a baby that was dead or some such, and they put it in a shoebox and took it home and played with it with their other live children. This guy doesn't need to be in public office. This guy needs to be in a home. That Rick Santorum. Why does the Philadelphia Inquirer give him space for the elephant in the room, Obama versus the United States? How dare they? Where were their columns about George Bush versus the United States for the last 8 years while every facet of civil liberty was under attack? Just where were they? I mean, this is a guy who called Democrats Nazis and did so on the floor of the United States Senate and wasn't even censured for it. So you know what kind of rhetoric is going to come out of his rotten mouth and his rat-infested brain. Well, you know what's going to come, but I may as well share it with you anyway. This is a quote from his column. This is what passes for thought between Rick Santorum's waxy little ears. This is cognition, the kind of cognition that takes place in the thin gray settlings that pass for brains in Rick Santorum's skull. From the elephant in the room, Obama versus the United States. Watching President Obama apologize last week for America's arrogance before a French audience that owes its freedom to the sacrifices of Americans helped convince me that he has a deep-seated antipathy toward American values and traditions. His nomination of former Yale Law School Dean Harold Coe to be the State Department's top lawyer constitutes further evidence of his disdain for American values. And, of course, it's not just Rick Santorum. It's a whole parade of freaks in and out of government, from Santorum to Michelle Bachmann to Sean and Hannity. On and on and on it goes. And it's dangerous. For the weak-minded in this country who are already convinced that Obama's going to get my guns, this is the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater. This is dangerous stuff. And just to, of course, in the center of this is the usual suspect lately. I really do. I worry about talking about Glenn Beck, rodeo clown. His words, not mine. I worry about talking because it seems like we're giving him more weight than he has. But I always come back down on the side of exposing this stuff because you and I don't watch Fox. And this is a means whereby we can sort of keep an eye on the lunatics of the hard right wing, the dangerous people. You'll note that in his column, or what passes for one,
Rick Santorum referred to Harold Coe. Who's Harold Coe? Well, Harold Coe is indeed the former dean of Yale Law School. And you have to really do the silly putty thing inside your brain to understand how a right-wing, I hate to use the word thought, but for want of a better word, thought process operates. But Harold Coe is Yale Law School dean. He has a deep, deep resume relating to international law and human rights law. And Barack Obama nominated him to be the legal advisor to the Department of State. Seems reasonable so far. But not to the loopy right wing.
State Department nominee Harold Coe, transnationalist legal views, are they a cause for concern?
Frank, I want... Transnationalist legal views, does that mean he wants to wear French clothing? Transnational... Oh.
I want to talk to you because there is a big debate on the internet and the New York Times and everybody else saying that I'm a crazy nut job because of Harold Coe. Harold Coe, who is now up to be the main attorney for international law in our State Department, he is for the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Tell me what that means to Americans and the Constitution. And
the Convention on the Rights of the Disqualified? What?
Article published in the Berkeley Journal of International Law
Berkeley.
In 2004, Harold Coe, somebody who Obama wants to be our State Department lawyer, he said, quote, what role can transnational legal process play in affecting the behavior of several nations whose disobedience with international law has attracted global attention after September 11th? Most prominently, North Korea, Iraq, and our own country, the United States of America. For shorthand purposes, I will call these countries the axis of disobedience. So in other words, if you can't get it done here, don't worry. The international court will come in over our Constitution and hold our people. And Frank, I thank you very much for being here.
You know, I don't think that those words mean what you think they mean, Glenda. Inconceivable. So they've got their knickers in a twist. In particular, over this he'd let international law take precedence over American law. Hear the mouth breathing? And as their grounds for this, they cite a speech that he gave to the Yale Alumni Association. That's Harvard, isn't it? I don't care. Yale Alumni Association of Greenwich, Connecticut, in which a little right-wing creep named Steve Stein got the notion that Harold Coe had said that he wants Islamic Sharia law to govern in U.S. courts. That's just a bunch of made-up stuff, because I'm trying not to use the fun words. The event was organized by a person by the name of Robin Reeves Zorthian. And Robin Reeves Zorthian wrote to the New York Post as follows. The account given by Steven Stein of Dean Coe's comments is totally fictitious and inaccurate. Where I come from, we'd say it this way. Steve Stein's big old liar. I was in the room with my husband and several fellow alumni, and we were all adamant that Coe never said or suggested that Sharia law could be used to govern cases in U.S. courts. The subject of his talk was globalization and Yale Law School, so of course other forms of law were mentioned. And Sharia is another form of law, whether the right wing likes it or not. Just like the Ten Commandments are another form of law. And the right wing is absolutely the crazier than a sprayed roach about the Mosaic law. You know, don't you eat no shellfish while wearing no polyester blend sweatshirt. Or we'll take you outside the city gates and stone you to death. You know, that kind of stuff. You know, you can no oysters, no crab legs, no pulled pork barbecue sandwiches, according to, you know, Leviticus or Exodus or some such stuff. So, yeah, other forms of law were mentioned. Other kinds of law, other legal codes. Maybe the code of, because, you know, they do this kind of stuff at Yale Law School. I think Mark Levine described it one time as, you know, if you go to another law school like, oh, say, Harvard on the Mon in West Virginia, they'll teach you about Hadley versus Baxendale and Mills and Times and Miller Time and so forth. Whereas what they do at Yale Law School is they think about the law as a concept, you know, the stuff that people like Socrates concerned themselves with. Meta law, I guess, is the way it was, I think is the way Levine described it to me. Robin Reeves says, of course, other forms of law were mentioned, but never did Coe state or suggest that other forms of law should govern or dictate the American legal system. And then she writes, hopefully, your readers are interested in the facts. Not if they're right wingers, Robin. Not if they're right wingers. You've got to remember their patron saint, Saint Ronnie of Raygun, declared, his declarations, if you are a right winger, cannot be challenged. Saint Ronnie of Raygun declared, "Well, facts are stupid things," and they are to a right winger. They get in the way all the time. Yeah, you want to run out there and holler that Obama's a secret Muslim, and then there's the fact that he's a Christian, and dang it, I just stumped my toe on a fact. You want to argue that he's going to, oh, we're all going to have to live under Sharia law. And then there's no evidence, factual evidence to support it. And, oh, you're running out of toes. When he's been in federal court, the Harold Coe, he argues federal law. I mean, really, if you're in front of the federal bench and you try to argue the Napoleonic Code, unless for some reason or another you're arguing some arcane point of Louisiana law, you're up a creek. You lost. This is, and this all goes back to the Santorum column. And he talks about Harold Coe and says, this seemingly obscure position in Foggy Bottom's bureaucratic maze is one of the most important in any administration. Shaping foreign policy in the courts and playing a critical role in international negotiations and treaties. Santorum says, let's set aside Coe's disputed comments about the possible application of Sharia law in American jurisprudence. By disputed, what he means is non-factual. The pick is alarming for more fundamental reasons, and a fundamentalist should know fundamental reasons, don't you suppose, having to do with national sovereignty and constitutional self-governance. What is indisputable, and whenever a right-winger says something's indisputable, you know to sort of rewind the Princess Bride to the Wallace Shawn part where he keeps saying, inconceivable! What is indisputable? I don't think you know what that... I don't think that word means what you think it means. Is that Coe calls himself a transnationalist. He believes U.S. courts, quote, must look beyond national interest to the mutual interests of all nations in a smoothly functioning international legal regime. All right, that reads a little bit like taffy. That's a little stretchy. Must look beyond national interest to the mutual interests of all nations in a smoothly functioning international legal regime. And that's a problem for Rick Santorum? I mean, that's really only problem a problem in an international legal regime or scheme. But if he'd called it a scheme, it would have been even worse because Glenn Beck and Rick Santorum and probably Michelle Bachmann would have told Minnesota to lock and load. Scheme? He's got a scheme? Look beyond national interest to the mutual interest. In other words, if you're going to set up a program of international law that everyone, that a majority or a plurality or a group or anybody can, if you're going to set up something that's going to call itself international law and is going to arbitrate disputes among nations, because I hate to break it to Rick Santorum, but the rest of the country or the rest of the world is not bound by federal law. And, you know, you'd think a right-winger would understand this, but it's also comprehensible that they wouldn't, because they are, after all, cafeteria legalists at the very best, or worse, depending on your perspective. Remember when we were trying to argue and I brought out some a quote from Thomas Jefferson saying, of course habeas corpus applies to people who aren't citizens of the United States. Because the right-wingers were arguing that habeas corpus did not apply to anybody who was not a citizen of the United States, and therefore we were free to hold Afghan goat herds guilty of nothing more than maybe making a pass at their neighbor's daughter 5 years ago that engendered a blood feud or some such ignorance as that. They argued that, you know, that guy who's been captured, who may or may not be guilty, the Uyghurs of Western China come to mind, not guilty, still in prison. The right-wingers like Santorum argued that, well, we could just keep him in Guantanamo indefinitely. Just, you know, give him their little orange jumpsuit, introduce him to Fido with the sharp, dripping teeth, and make sure that they behave, and give them a bucket that they can put their bodily effluence in, hand them a copy of the Koran, and pass them a little bit of barbecued pork pig every once in a while. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Because being foreign to the United States, they were not entitled to the application of federal law. And yet here we have, by extension, Rick Santorum, not the brightest bulb in the socket, arguing that what? That federal law should govern international law? That say, trade disputes among nations should be... What? Because what Harold Coe is saying is that you've got to sit down and negotiate. And you've got to build a legal framework that will be acceptable to everybody who is going to participate in the process, or else the process won't work. And for that, he gets called a transnationalist. Santorum goes on, he thinks the courts have a, quote, central role to play in domesticating international law into U.S. law. Well, who else would do that? Oh, I know, Rick Santorum would do that. See, that's the problem with the right-wingers. They only like the courts if they control them. And he thinks courts should use their interpretive powers to promote the development of a global legal system. Oh, God, I can hear the Alex Jones listeners now. One world government, oh! But of course, I mean, you sit down in constitutional law in the first year of law school, and just about the first thing you read is Marbury versus Madison, right? And that, and it's not so much about what happened in Marbury versus Madison, but for a rather innocuous seeming but turned out to be quite substantial statement made by the court. And that was that the Supreme Court of the United States would be the final arbiter of all legal disputes that the interpretation of the Constitution was once and for all fully and finally vested in the Supreme Court, in the courts of the United States. In other words, that the Supreme Court on issues of constitutional interpretation would trump the other two branches. And saying that courts should use their interpretive powers to promote the development of a global legal system is saying nothing more than that federal courts should continue doing what federal courts have been doing since Marbury versus Madison came out. That kind of only makes sense to me. But in Rick Santorum world, which is, you know, of course, spinning retrograde around some distant star and weird gravity and the air does strange things to the right. So now that Rick Santorum has set up his straw man, he's going to knock it down because Rick Santorum's a bold legal scholar. Got his law degree on the back of a matchbook. It said, draw the pirate on the front. Draw Spunky. So he sets up his straw man, and here comes the big knockout blow to the straw man. Coe's transnationalism stands in contrast to good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty. Really? Good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty? Didn't our good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty used to include the fact that we would be the final determinants of whether, oh, I don't know, slavery would exist in the United States of America? Didn't good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty once tell the world to piss off that we would tell our women whether or not they could vote? Didn't our good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty say that we, the United States, would determine whether or not a person of color could go to the polls and vote without trying to write their name on a piece of wax paper with a ballpoint pen or passing a literacy test by trying to read a Chinese restaurant menu? Is that what Rick Santorum means? See how a straw man works? I'm doing it now, by the way. Is that what Rick Santorum means by good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty? Yes, national, good old-fashioned national sovereignty with a dollop of ice cream and a little bit of chocolate sauce and cherry on top. Dang it. It's coming up on warm weather, and good old-fashioned national sovereignty always goes better with a little bit of ice cream and a cherry on the top, maybe a little whipped cream, chocolate syrup. Oh, good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty in which our Constitution is the highest law of the land. Rick, there's nothing in anything that Harold Coe has ever said that indicates that the supremacy of the Constitution is in any wise in jeopardy. Stop making stuff up. Quit, as we say around here, lying your ass off. In the traditional view, controversial matters, whatever they may be, are subject to democratic debate here. They should be resolved by the American people and their representatives, not internationalized. That Constitution he was talking about was supposed to be the final arbiter in good old-fashioned notions of national sovereignty? Well, that Constitution says that the Senate, that the President shall have the power of negotiating treaties, and that the Senate shall have the power of ratifying the same. That's not a quote, but that's what it comes out meaning. In other words, President goes over like Woodrow Wilson did. Woodrow Wilson helped negotiate the treaty that created the League of Nations in an effort to make sure that World War I never, ever, ever happened again. And he brought it home, and the Republicans looked at it and said, not on your life, Buster. We don't want to be having any democratic processes with any other countries in the world. You ain't getting no League of Nations. So Woodrow Wilson took off and went all across the country, wound up having a humongous stroke. His wife wound up being president of the United States de facto for a while. And we didn't join the League of Nations. And a decade or so, just a few years later, a little punk-ass bastard with a Charlie Chaplin mustache started goose-stepping all over Germany, and the next thing you know, there's smoke rising out of ovens of crematoria in Poland. All because another dead-from-the-neck-up gang of Republicans from 90 years ago took the same view that Rick Santorum is taking now. The Senate ratifies treaties negotiated by the president. However, Rick Santorum has a completely different view and says they should be released. These controversial matters should be resolved by the American people and their representatives, not internationalized. Whatever the hell that means. And then this snide little comment. God, I hate it when right-wingers are snarky because they're so stupid in the first place, it makes them come across even more so. Which makes life easier for me, I suppose. What Holland or Belgium or Kenya or any other nation... Oh, we had to get Kenya in there, didn't we? You know, Kenya. Where Barack Obama was really born, and that's why it is that he has a deep-seated antipathy toward American values and traditions. His traditions are Kenyan traditions. See, I'm getting some code in there, boys and girls. What Holland or Belgium or Kenya or any other nation or coalition of nations thinks has no bearing on our exercise of executive, legislative, or judicial power. Who said that it does? Harold Coe didn't. Now, I've been sitting on this Harold Coe story for a few days because it deserved a little bit of time. And then, as usually turns out to be the case, if you let one of these little pot boilers just simmer along for a couple of days, it's like bait to a right winger. And sooner or later, one of them will take it. In this case, being Rick Santorum, washed up, done. Out of business, right-wing former senator from Pennsylvania. So Santorum has made his assertion, and he follows by saying, well, Coe disagrees. He would decide such matters based on the views of other countries or transnational organizations, or rather, those entities' elites. Oh, there's the elite again. The interesting thing about that rather short paragraph, and that's a whole paragraph I just read to you, is that it contains no citation to anything of a factual nature whatsoever. Unsurprisingly, Coe is a strong supporter of the International Criminal Court, which could subject U.S. soldiers and officials to foreign criminal trials for their actions while fighting for our security. No. No, Rick, it couldn't. The International Criminal Court would have jurisdiction over international war crimes. The only way an American citizen winds up in front of them is if they are believed by a competent legal standard to have committed war crimes. I mean, I kind of wish it was the way Rick Santorum describes it, because then somebody could go and snatch G.W. Bush right out of his Barca lounger, throw a bag over his head, and put him in a dock at The Hague, and we could have justice over what he did for the last 8 years, once and for flippin' all. Oops, I'm angry. Our Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment? Coe believes it should be reinterpreted in light of foreign and international law to pay decent respect to the opinions of humankind. Well, you know, we don't want any decent respect to the opinions of humankind in our Eighth Amendment now, do we, Rick? Then again, this guy plays with corpses, so what do you want from his brain? Old fogies like me Oh, isn't that just charming? Isn't it endearing? He called himself an old fogey. Believe we ought to pay more attention to the opinions of the founders who wrote the Constitution and the people who have lived under it. Well, if that's the case, Rick Santorum, then get on board the extend habeas corpus to everybody in the world express, because that's what one of the founders said. Of course habeas corpus would be extended to everyone, said Thomas Jefferson. If Americans want to end the death penalty, they can do so through their elected state representatives. But this is only one little piece in a puzzle. This is only yet another set piece in the right-wing hatred intended to gin up violence, terror, frenzied, sick-minded behavior in the right wing. You see, the right wing can't, as we've noted on a number of occasions, can't compete in the marketplace of ideas without having a whipped-up, frenzied-up base. If they don't have the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, faithful, absolutely dripping at the fangs, they know they're done. Because in the realm of reason and common sense, they just lose. They can't compete. We've been through two-thirds of an entire column that is based on literally thin air. Listen to this again with the straw man. If foreign opinions trump those of Pennsylvanians on capital punishment, why not on other issues? Why not indeed? Coe thinks international comity trumps American sovereignty. No, he doesn't. The only quote there is international comity. It's C-O-M-I-T-Y, not C-O-M-E-D-Y. He believes that since certain nations recognize a right to same-sex marriage, our courts should too. Well, it does raise a substantial legal issue. What happens if a couple who are married in one country come to the United States? I mean, the eternal problem with the law is that it's always two or three steps behind reality and the present. But what indeed? How do you answer that question? If a pair of refugees, for whatever reason, seek sanctuary in the United States and in their home country they were married and they are of the same sex, how do we tell them that their love for one another and their union is no longer valid in this place that they've been told is the land of the free and the place from which they can flee persecution? Not an easy question, is it? I mean, for me, it's an easy question. You look up and you say, well, you're married here too. Go, live, be well, be prosperous, have a happy life. Hope it all works out. But not to the right wing. Because the right wing wants to involve itself in every last blessed aspect of the entire human process. Especially where that sex part's concerned. Because they really like the sex part! This is an astonishing display of right-wing hate, right-wing intolerance, and I suppose most of all, right-wing ignorance. What's beneath this legal jargon? Simply this. Even if marriage in Pennsylvania has always been understood as involving one man and one woman. Even if Pennsylvanians, through referendum or constitutional amendment, decide it should remain so, none of that should count. What should count are the views of courts in other nations or international bodies. No one has said anything of the sort. Rick Santorum, for all he preaches of being a pious, pre-Vatican II, Roman Catholic, the holiness dude, is nothing short of an authoritarian thug who is intolerant of anything that smacks of being different from his sick, twisted view of what reality should be. And all of this, I've read you practically, I've read from practically the entire column. And we can see, you know, you can go and see it for yourself. It's at philly.com/inquirer. That's inquirer with an I. /opinion. philly.com/inquirer/opinion. You'll find it. He's even got an email account at the newspaper, although I find it difficult to believe. rsantorum@phillynews.com. Coe tops the list of Obama's potential Supreme Court nominees. Is this what Senator John Kerry meant when he once suggested that American policy must pass a global test? What? John Kerry? How'd he get in the room? But at the end of the day, the final analysis, the ultimate purpose is in the subhead. The president is contemptuous of American values. Well, if the president's contemptuous of American values, what does that mean? What needs to happen to that president? These right-wingers are having an eliminationist fit. I don't know what they plan to do to Joe Biden, but they want Barack Obama out of the way. It is driving them mad that he is breathing on the planet. And therefore they can use inflammatory language like he has a deep-seated antipathy toward American values and traditions. I mean, that's not even a stone's throw distant from he's not really American. Which, of course, they argued themselves hoarse, screaming during the election cycle. He has a deep-seated antipathy toward American values and traditions. Do yourself a favor. If you can find it, go and read what some of the right wing was saying during the earliest days of the Kennedy administration. Here's a hint. It's not far different. Not far different at all. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
I was sitting downstairs early this afternoon watching the History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Tom Brokaw special that he did about 1968. Rather harrowing year for those of us who remember it. That was the year Martin Luther King was murdered.
Yeah.
That was the year of the Chicago Convention. I like to call it the Chicago Police Riot, where student blood ran in the streets when the Chicago police went after the unarmed students and beat the holy living crap out of them.
Yep.
And that was the year that Bobby was murdered.
Yes, it was a brutal year across the board.
And It was also one other year. It was the year of Stonewall.
Yes.
That was the year when a bunch of drag queens finally had said, no, we're not going to take it anymore, and they started fighting back.
Yes.
And this time, a bunch of cops got bloodied. And about damn time, because they were doing it for sport. Now, the reason I'm calling is because what I'm hearing from the right wing sounds an awful lot like what was coming out of 1968, right down to the war. The only difference is we don't have student movements on the campuses that we did because they're smart enough not to use a draft.
Right. And that was
68 all over again.
Right. No draft, largely in apathetic students.
Yeah. It's 68 all over again. And as angry as I am at Obama, I don't want to live through another assassination. And so that man had better do everything his security detail tells him to and do it fast.
Well, I don't like talking about this kind of stuff, Susan, but I am convinced
I don't either.
That the right wing means him no good. And I have yet to hear a right winger who is talking this crap say that they retract any of it. You know, Michelle Bachmann, I think he's anti-American. I think there needs to be an investigation. All of it, you know. How much more blatant can you get than what Santorum has said? He has a deep antipathy to American values.
Yeah, Baucus has come up with a list of socialists in the House of Representatives. A secret list.
Well, they always are, aren't they?
Oh, yes. He says there are 17.
Yeah, didn't McCarthy have a secret list that he waived at that meeting in Wheeling, West Virginia?
Sheet of paper. Yeah, it was a sheet, blank sheet of paper. I can tell you one thing.
Yes?
Now, I lived through all of that, and all I ended up with was a broken heart.
That is still cracked and not fully healed.
Yeah.
That's a whole generation.
Yeah. That basically, after Bobby died, just basically said, screw it. The hell with the whole mess. We don't need this crap. And we just basically turned off. Until this year. When we realized it was now or never. No. It was either do something now or go down the toilet. But I can tell the right wingers this. Don't do it again because I will come after you with blood in my eye. I'm old, I'm fat, but I know because I had a very misspent youth.
Well, you and your generation on the one hand know that of which you were deprived. I and my generation can only look back and wonder what might have been, what we might have had. And this is, you know, you said at the beginning of the conversation, you said, no matter how upset with him I am, and there is, the domestic spying business, the wiretapping business, is incredibly disturbing.
Oh, yeah.
It's disturbing on levels that I can barely even begin to give voice to. I'm astonished, Susan.
Yeah.
I'm astonished that the Obama administration DOJ could make this tone deaf a decision.
Yeah, let me put this way. If they don't change their position, I'm going to start calling for impeachment.
No, we're not going to.
Crap, I am.
Well, not they're not. They're, but if
well, be
well, legal. There's too much. There's too much. Too complicated a process to. No.
I don't expect it to do anything, but
he's not 100. Susan, he's not 100. He's not 100 days in, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, but I expect something like that to, from my side of the fence, to get their attention.
Well, but be careful about hollering for something like that, because as Bart Kopp frequently notes, the Democrats are very good at turning on their own. You know, we were scared of George Bush, so we let him get away with murder. But Democrat?
I'm not gonna sit around for four or five years and let this guy rip up the Constitution. We did that with George Bush. I'm not going to let him do it again. It's the proverbial rock or the hard place. But either way, it's going to be what I will do will be done legally, as set down in the Constitution of the United States. It will be a peaceful process, the whole nine yards. If the right wingers choose violence.
Well, but bear in mind, they're not talking about rioting in the streets. That's what
no,
their little tea parties are about. They just want to find, they just want to light up and militarize and activize enough loonies like the guy in Pittsburgh or the guy in East Tennessee last summer to get a couple of good shots in.
Yeah, they're praying that is crazy enough to pick up a long-range rifle with a scope and put a bullet in. That's what they're hoping for. They're slavering for it. And Glenn Beck, if it happens, I will be coming for you.
Well, there's a long list, Susan. There's a long list of the people who are inciting
because
this stuff.
Because I'm not going to stand by and just mourn. If it happens, I don't want it. Anything I do will be peaceful unless that happens, because there's a verse in the Bible about reaping the whirlwind.
Yep.
Pay attention, guys. Pay attention to the Bible that you profess to pay so much attention to. Because you will certainly reap the whirlwind.
Well, I just hope we can sort of, to the extent that it is humanly possible, I hope we can put it out there where people can hear and consider and just be aware. You know, simple alertness, simple awareness of what the right wing is trying to do may be enough to stop them. Because, among other things, they are a cowardly lot. They are cut purses and sneak thieves and foot pads. They do not like to operate in the sunshine.
That's what I'm hoping for, that if they are told flat out, guys, if the man goes down, it won't be just the shooter this time.
Well, let's not even go there.
So, yeah, they have to be told that, you know, hey, we know what you're doing. And we know why you're doing it. Don't do this because you'll pay. And I really hope the families of those three police officers who died in Pennsylvania turn around and sue Glenn Beck for 110% of his income for the rest of his life.
And they won't get a dime if they do. They won't.
Probably not.
The relationship is far too attenuated.
Even on a civil basis?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, if you had Glenn Beck sitting in front of the camera saying, Richard Poplawski, lock and load, and blah, 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 then you'd have a connection. But remember, the Son of Sam said that the dog was telling him what to do. There's no rational connection.
Yeah, what's really, yeah, probably, what's his face, the shooter in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, is probably going to get off with an insanity plea, too.
Nah. No, he won't get, no. Insanity pleas are incredibly difficult to make stick. He's gonna go do life, or else he's gonna do the horizontal crucifixion if that's what Pennsylvania's into.
Personally, I'm not in favor of the death penalty because I can, for one very very simple reason. I consider the death penalty be merciful.
Oh, if he does hard time in Pennsylvania, his life is going to be real tough because prison guards don't like cop killers.
Yeah, and you know, anybody who does hard time for the rest of their life, hey, now that's punishment.
Yeah.
And if you lure, I'm a child of the 60s. I don't necessarily like cops. But luring three cops to a domestic dispute just so you can kill them? No.
No. Sophie in the chat room is pointing out a quote from Freeperville. This is the quote, Susan. And let's face it, all the speculation about Obama being the actual Antichrist will either be confirmed or denied if someone gets off a lucky shot at the SOB.
Yeah.
They're talking it. You know, I don't even like acknowledging that they're talking it, but they're talking it.
Oh, yeah, they are.
And frankly, you know, my purpose in this, and if I didn't finish it, let me finish it now. Be alert to it. And don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call the Secret Service if you hear some wingnut talking that crap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because if we are not alert to it, somebody could get through.
Every time you build a better lock.
Yeah.
A burglar builds a better lock, a better pick.
A better lock. All it takes is somebody willing to die.
But this is just getting way too dark.
Yeah, it's getting bad. It's the tone of this of the Freepers is just getting really, really scary, and it just makes me really, really.
And bear in mind, these people are not they are right wing freaks, and they are of limited intelligence. But they know how far they can go, and they will not cross that line. At least, you know, the broadcasters, the Becks and the Alex Joneses and so forth of the world. They won't cross that line. They will leave their listeners to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, they'll leave it to the crazy ones to do the crossing. And then the rest of the country gets to pick up the pieces. Gee, thanks a lot, guys.
But, you know, again, we are, let's see, January, February, March, April. We're not 3 months into the man's term, and they are already at this murderous fever pitch.
Yeah, I know.
It is the citizenry of the United States who are called upon for their diligence in this matter, Susan, their diligence.
Exactly. On a lighter note, Arizona State University has informed Obama that he will not be awarded an honorary degree because he hasn't done enough with his life.
Mighty high standards for the Sun Devils.
Honest to God.
Well, you know, there's a benchmark standard there. Did they give an honorary degree to Dim Leader?
Probably.
Well, no probablys or not. If they did, then they're miserable hypocrites. If they didn't, then you know, that's their call.
It says because, quote, his body of work is yet to come. Say what?
In other words, they don't want to give a guy an honorary degree and then have him turn out to be a one-termer. And have him called Jimmy Carter Part 2. They don't want that on their record.
Never mind the fact that he is first.
None of that matters. No. This is all what have you done for me lately stuff.
Oh, God.
Beautiful. Just beautiful. Susan, take care, dear.
Love to Agnes.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. News Ninja Susan calling from Columbia City, Oregon. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. What's going on?
Reverbo, what's up?
Well, I have tons of things are up, but I can't let this. I have to start with right away giving you credit. Rock pile, nicely done.
Oh, that took a minute. You know, the usual suspects were there. Reverbo, Hot for Teacher.
Oh man, Dave Evans, he is a god in my religion. Excellent.
That took some doing too. I had to put out a call.
Oh man, because
I thought I had it, but I couldn't find it.
I'll send you some more Dave Edmonds. It's doesn't get much better than him. Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum, I believe, also was the guy who his comment about the Catholic priests who molested all those young boys in Boston. Remember, I think according to Mr. Santorum, he not only wasn't surprised that it happened in Boston, he just figured that was a good place for it. Because it was so liberal.
Oh, God, I had forgotten. I try so hard, Reverbo. I do. I try.
Oh, well, he would Santorum. He's so difficult to forget. Yeah, he actually...
Well, whoever came up with that definition of Santorum did terrible, terrible things to my brain.
Yeah, I remember that one, too. And Woodrow Wilson. Let's see, League of Nations. That was a no. Woodrow, could you sign this over here, though? Okay, what's this? You just created the Federal Reserve. Thank you.
Yeah, because the banksters like that.
Yeah, they did happen to like that. So, and now Woodrow's going to, I guess, he took a nap. And did his wife really run the country for a while? Is that the story?
Yeah, Edith Wilson.
Edith Wilson.
Basically was the gatekeeper to the cabinet and would not let anybody in to see Woodrow. And would carry messages back out of what Woodrow wanted. And for a guy who is basically incommunicado from a stroke, that meant that she was doing the best, her best Woodrow Wilson impression. Oh, she was quite fierce about it. She was quite admirable about it. She was not going to get moved out of the White House.
When did he croak?
Oh Lord! Now you got to. This won't take but a minute. You know, because it goes. Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover. He died February 3rd, 1924. He was. Re-elected in 1916, so his term ended in what would have been March 1921, when Warren Gamaliel Harding, the Republican nominee, and until the rise of George W. Bush, the single stupidest man ever to inhabit the White House, was elected.
Yeah, so Wilson was succeeded by 3 one-termers.
Yeah, well, Wilson... No, not really. Warren G. Harding dropped dead, and his vice president was Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, okay.
And then Harding, and then Hoover came along in the 1928 election. So he took office March of 1929.
And then Roosevelt picks things up in 32.
Well, no. Well, technically, March of 1933.
March of 33.
Yeah, Warren G. Harding dropped dead August 2nd, 1923.
Well, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about population control.
We can certainly try.
I sent you a bunch of bunch of stuff from this guy, Chris Hedges, that I have recently discovered.
Yeah, I saw that earlier today. It was all Chris Hedges is an amazing writer.
Oh, he is. And the thing that got me, and this dovetails really with all your issues with the coal and cheap energy, clean energy, it really, the quality of life, all of that. Because, you know, it's sort of like there's no point in even discussing the budget or discussing entitlement programs or discussing how we're going to spend our money. The elephant in the room is the Department of Defense. Until people throw that.
It's a whole herd.
Yeah, there's no point in even talking about it unless you throw in the Pentagon. Well, I don't think there's any point. I mean, yeah, I hope they do discuss it, obviously. But there's no, unless you talk about managing people, I don't know how you can even have any kind of discussion about the future, about development or growth, without addressing that. And people just will not touch it.
Well, I remember when Dennis Kucinich made the factual argument that we could provide national single-payer health care on what I at the term was describing as the change we shake out of the Pentagon's couch. He said if we simply clean up the waste, fraud, and abuse at the Pentagon, that money itself would be sufficient to fund national single-payer health care.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost a straw man when they start parading around all the social entitlement programs. Yeah, all the social entitlement programs are dropping the bucket compared to a couple of nuclear subs. I mean, nobody touches that one either. Nobody touches immigration. They're starting to touch it. There are some people that aren't just relentlessly stupid. But it's just taking a very long time. In that one article, Hedges says that we will be between 8 billion and 10 billion people by 2050. Now, that's a lot of folks who are going to be looking for supper and looking for a job and looking for a house, man. I can't even wrap my brain around that.
And where do they all go?
Well, where do they all go? We already got a food supply problem because the planet's warming up. We got a problem. We got a problem now. I don't know where they go. Well, and of course, while the
short-sighted executive class, whatever else you want to call them, are fretting about oil, all those billions you're talking about there, Reverbo, they're going to be interested in something much more prosaic, and they will be willing to kill to get it if they don't die first. Water.
Yeah.
Water.
Yeah, water.
And global warming is not going to be, oh, well, see, we'll have more water with global warming because the ice caps will. No. No, because that goes into the oceans and they're going to be saline, and no, it doesn't work that way.
Damn, because George Bush thought it did work that way.
Now, you can't use George Bush and thought in the same sentence. I thought we established these rules of engagement, Reverbo.
He came to my kid's science class, and he trotted out that very explanation for the whole water thing, just like you did. God, crap. He's wrong again. Oh, well.
Who could possibly imagine it?
Yeah, I don't know. The thing, well, let's see. So where were we on this? Okay, so the United States already consumes, what, 25% of the world's resources already. And, of course, what we're going to do about this.
And we're not going to lower that number anytime soon, because if you start talking about something like that, then Rick Santorum pens a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer and says you have antipathy toward American values.
I'm kind of confused about the whole globalist world market, free market, national values thing, Bob. Can you clear this up for me? When is it cool to be like a globalist, and when is it not cool? I'm really having a hard time with this.
Well, when the globalism makes money for us, and particularly for right-wing corporations and defense industry corporations, then the global market's really cool. For instance, let's say you've got two warring nations in the Middle East, and you're able to sell guns, bombs, and bullets to both sides. Then globalism's really neat. If, on the other hand, the United States is doing something vile and predatory that is harmful to the rest of the world, globalism sucks.
Boy, that's like, that's tough to know. I mean, it's hard getting up.
It's the hockeyest of ad hoc standards. I'll admit.
Yeah, I mean,
you can't even tell the players with a program under that situation.
Tell them whether you're coming or going with that one. But well, it's good that they, at least they know that, and they can just tell me when I'm doing it right, when I'm behaving correctly. What do we have here? I grew up in Baltimore, and then I spent the majority of my life in Colorado. So actually, Preston and I have a lot in common. I'm well acquainted with Colorado politics. I was out there for almost 40 years before I came back east and settled down here in Possum Country, which is could be a temporary situation due to, well, I don't want to go, but even that's not why I called.
Okay.
But one of the things that, back to the East Coast, one of the things that I have always been aware of is, and it's like, you know, you've got a problem with, they're blowing up the tops of your mountains. Well, they're ruining my bay. The Chesapeake Bay is dying.
Yeah, there's one stream left that is actually a fully functioning, healthy stream that feeds into the Chesapeake Bay. And there are developers who want to make sure that it's not anymore.
Well, and you hit on the key word. Let me get that bell here. Yes, developers. Because I was looking at this article, and I guess the Chesapeake Bay is almost done with a 25-year plan of cleaning it up, and it has abysmally failed. 25 years has accomplished nothing. They still have all the nitrogen in the bay, the nitrogen problem that they've had. They're still losing all the animals. They're losing all the oysters and the crabs. They have not come back. It's polluted as it ever was.
Right, because they never really stopped the pollution.
Well, what they didn't stop were the people. And this guy's point, and, okay, let's be honest here. You don't have an overpopulation problem in West Virginia. But the last time I looked, the coal companies in West Virginia were just not selling their coal to light up people's houses in Beckley, were they?
No.
So this is, everybody's downstream to use.
Well, and exactly. And to extend where I think you're going, not that I'm cutting you off.
No.
It is in, for instance, when the power company here in West Virginia recently asked for a 50%+ rate increase. Over the next 2 years. They said that the reason they needed it was because they bought a lot of coal when coal was really expensive, and that because of economic downturns, other companies were not buying coal from them like they had in the past, and buying coal-fired power from them like they had in the past.
What a shame. So they get to sort of pass that on to you.
Yeah, so their bad choices are my responsibility. You know, that personal responsibility the right wing's forever talking about does not apply to corporate America. But to go beyond that for just a minute, Reverbo, what that also means, the background or the underpinnings of the Appalachian Power argument is that their business model is to facilitate out-of-control growth. Because as long as more people are using electricity, then they're able to sell more electricity to the more people who are using it. In other words, it is to Appalachian Power's benefit to have these predatory domestic situations where there are four televisions going and nobody watching them, three refrigerators, a couple of freezers, and lights left on in every room. That's good for business. Bad for the planet, but good for business.
Oh, cheap trumps clean any day of the week. And you didn't steal my thunder. You're supplementing my entire point here. Listen to what this guy says about the bay. He's describing why this has been a failure. And he says a blind spot remains whenever people get together and they try to come up with some kind of plan to fix these things. And the blind spot is exactly what he says. I will quote him. The blind spot is our addiction to limitless economic growth based on encouraging an ever-expanding population of human consumers to support it.
Which goes back to that marvelous little piece of internet footage, the story of stuff. Storyofstuff.com. It should be required viewing for everyone because it talks about the creation of the consumer culture and who created it. And the problem with a consumer culture is that it eats itself. It is self-consuming. Yeah, we're going to keep having more people, and we seem to be manipulating the world markets in such a way as we can, so as to extend the need for meaningless stuff to ever more people, and we define that as raising them out of poverty. You know, the vast majority of the planet, I dare say, Reverbo, is still just a little bit above the Stone Age. A guy recently won an award. And it's really cool what he did. The Financial Times and some foundation sponsored a contest. And the contest was to invent something that was really, really beneficial to humanity. And what the guy invented was a cardboard box oven. And the oven is now in production in either Nigeria or Kenya by a factory that can produce 2.5 million units. It is literally two cardboard boxes. One of them is lined is coated or covered with aluminum foil, and the other one, the other box, is coated with black paint, and it's got a plexiglass lid that magnifies sunlight, and it'll boil water, and it'll cook food.
Oven, a free power oven.
And he's and what the hope is that by producing these things, deforestation will be reduced by the number of people who have to go and cut down forests to come up with firewood with which to cook. Because Homo sapiens sapiens still has that cooked food thing going.
They do. And it is a race between blowing everything up and cutting it all down to accommodate all these people. and I'm not sure the race, some parts of the world may win, the race may come out. I mean, I don't know. I'm not betting on this. I don't know what to think about this. The Chesapeake Bay, there are 17 million people live along Chesapeake Bay today. And in the 1950s, there were 8 million. One need not go any farther along in the story than that sentence right there. All these people need to power those high-definition TVs. All those people need those big houses and big yards. Hey, you got a big yard. I'll bet you need some fertilizer on that yard there, Chief.
Yeah, and that's another movement that I'm really fond of.
Watering yards, yeah.
No, the movement to turn yards into gardens.
Oh, you mean the whole xeriscape, just get rid of the Kentucky bluegrass completely. Yeah, I agree.
Because if you get right down to it, the whole lawn concept, not a yard, but a lawn, that's another one of those white folks things that just ain't working out so well for the rest of the world.
No, it's not.
I mean, if you read the segment on Rwanda, in Jared Diamond's Collapse, you will find that, you know, he steps away from the Hutu versus Tutsi argument and talks about carrying capacity of the land. And the numbers that he cites for, you know, 30 people living on little parcels of carved out of 1 acre and, you know, feeding themselves on that little parcel. That's a world that can't support lawns. And by the time you get to those 8 or 10 billion people you were talking about, lawns are gone.
Some people feel entitled to lawns still. We got some people, you got to pry their lawn out of their...
You can have my lawn when you pry it for my cold, dead fingers?
Well, you know, we're just singing to the choir here. But it is the race. Are we going to blow it up or are we going to fix it? I mean, none of that. You eat, you have to fertilize. You got to heat your place. You got to cool your place. We got sewage plants, water treatment plants. We got to build more county dumps. We got more shopping centers. There are more roads. It's all because of people. I mean, there's just no way to even have any kind of...
Well, the fact of the matter is the world has probably passed carrying capacity, Reverbo.
It may be.
And we are artificially propping up the carrying capacity of the planet by making sure that, we use 25% of the world's resources in the United States, but you know that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Maybe that's been discredited. But for the one, for one guy to live in the lap of luxury and have an acre of Kentucky bluegrass or Bermuda grass or whatever lawn, that means that 10 or 12 people somewhere else on the planet eat dirt. And there is a direct connection between the two.
Everybody is downstream. Oh, can you say social unrest? I mean, this is, I don't know. I try to stay upbeat, and then I listen to your show, decide to call your show, and then I get all agitated.
You're going to have people, you said this a couple of times, you're going to have people convinced that I'm nothing but a terminal downer.
God, I woke up this morning, and I was just really pretty much ready to just sing tra-la-la, you know that? Now, we can't finish this discussion, though, without leaving out our friends, the religious fundamentalists of all stripes, who, of course, continue to add to this madness of the population problem by, let's see, I don't know, not believing in birth control, perhaps, procreating to just create more of them. That's, that whole dominion thing we were talking about.
And the Reconstruction, Christian Reconstructionism thing, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Quiver babies?
There you go.
You've read about the quiver babies, right?
Oh, yeah, I can barely even deal with that.
That one sends you right out the door screaming, doesn't it?
Yeah, men have all that. Men should, the arrows in my quiver, I should shoot into the woman, and the only time she's not pregnant is when she's recovering from her last pregnancy, and it's 2009.
Your Christian children are quivers in the, are arrows in the quiver of the Lord.
I'm going to just throw this concept out to you and just see what you think.
Okay.
You would think by now, you would think by now we would have transcended some of this stuff, wouldn't you? Transcended things like myth and violence, and we'd have moved into this compassionate and harmonious world, wouldn't you?
Oh, you mean the Star Trek world where all we have to worry about is the Borg?
Wouldn't you? Here, I'll tell you, this is...
You would.
This is going to work for me. See, I don't do the... I'm not big on details. I like to do the introduction and then the first and last chapters. Someone else can do the middle of the book. The intro and the outro. That's what I'm best at. And I've got this concept in my mind of a book that I will probably never write. And it's called something like The Culture of Abuse. And the point, and it kind of goes like this, that I don't care what model that you use that promotes it, and I don't care what kind of abuse it is, if it's abuse against women because they're not going to sleep with you tonight, or it's abuse against nature, or it's abuse against, or you're abusing my trust, you're gambling with my 401k, I don't care. I do not give a shit. It is abuse, no matter how you cut it. I don't care if it's religious abuse or political or economic. But while you are here on my planet, you cannot behave this way. And I don't care what God you worship, because some of us just don't want it. There's my book. Who's going to buy a book like that? It's sad and it's boring.
I think you do the ladies and gentlemen welcome and the thank you very much good night part. It sounds to me like there's a fascinating book in the middle of that. Sort of like the one that I've got banging around in my brain, and someone's free to pick this up and run with it.
Go for it. I
look around at West Virginia, Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, and all the sludge seas. They're not dams. They're not containments. They're seas. They're sea. You know, if you've got 9 billion gallons of something liquid in something, it's a sea. Okay, it's a lake at least. But lake's so prosaic, you know, it's a dead sea. Way above sea level, a dead sea. But anyway, you got all these things, and they're all over Appalachia, and they're toxic, and they're not going anywhere, and there are no plans to deal with them. I mean, zero plans to deal with these things, 9 billion, 8 billion, 2 billion gallons at a time, no plans. And the assumption is that those dirt dams will just always be there. So, old science fiction freak that I am, I've been wondering, and I don't know if this is a book or a movie. I'll be happy to consult for a small fee. But what happens, and I don't want to get all Mad Max, post-apocalypse, all of that stuff, but what happens, and this is just based on the expansion and contraction of cultures, as they always do. You know, look at what happened after Rome. Christianity comes along, they forget all their technology, and the next thing you know, they're burning witches. What happens when some remnant people living in Appalachia, 1,000 years from now, assuming that the dams last 1,000 years, what happens when one of those clans, tribes, family units, in the course of its hunting and gathering, wanders onto one of these sludge seas?
They get kind of sick.
Are kind of dead. And what kind of mythology do they build around them? Those are the questions I'm asking, and just wondering what the book, you know, what the story would be. Is it as compelling? Do I convey it as compellingly as it exists in my brain?
You will. If you don't now, I believe you will, because I like this. It's kind of a science fiction thing.
I see these people who are speaking a sort of hodgepodge of probably Spanish and English, and it's all evolved into something. That's about 50 miles past the hodgepodge English and Russian of, say, Clockwork Orange. And we don't know if they've got electricity anymore. We don't know, maybe some of the technology has survived. We don't know what parts. They probably don't have, internal combustion or self-motive vehicles. They gotta walk to where they're going. Don't know. Maybe they got horses. And what happens when they get into this toxin? So
I like the whole. I always like the concept of how what would someone think. If you drop them, it's like, what would we think if we landed on some planet?
News Ninja Gene is pointing out, he said it would be a cursed place where the demons live.
Well, now I'm starting to think Stephen King, yeah. You ever read The Stand?
Yes.
Yeah. I like your idea.
But I think it's far more visual than prose.
Yeah, but I can see it. I mean, in 1,000 years, who knows what's? We are well on our way to blowing ourselves up. I mean, you can make a case for that just as easily as you could say.
Well, we're already starving ourselves out.
Well, yeah, we're already blowing up the mountains. We're already killing the bays. All these people, every one of these people that is haven't been born yet and are planning on being born, they all have these needs that are at the moment still tied to oil and coal. You know that.
Yes.
We're not going to have any. It's just like you can't even have a discussion about the alternative power as long as, unless you factor out the coal.
Did you see the stunning statement? Oh, there goes the Internet Explorer. Did you see the stunning statement from Interior Secretary Ken Salazar?
Oh, he's a Colorado boy that we were glad to get rid of.
Well, yeah, and he gave me pause for reflection when he became Interior Secretary. But he came out and said something the other day that just kind of made me jump for joy.
I missed it. What did he say?
He said, he said that the wind potential off the Atlantic seaboard is such that if we built wind farms off the Atlantic seaboard, there would be enough electricity produced virtually, practically perpetually, that it would be three times the amount of electricity produced by every coal-fired power plant in the United States right now.
Who did he say this to?
It was a speech.
God, Ken, you're showing me something.
Let me see if I can rouse that up real quick.
Now, I've heard this speech, you know, for the last 40 years, of course, but it's always nice to hear.
Well, the Internet Explorer just crashed on me again. Damn it!
And there's hope for Ken Salazar.
But I had. Just a second. No. Well, I can search it up real quick.
Anyway, that's very promising. That's
well, the funny thing is the response from the coal industry.
Oh, I'm sure that was hilarious.
Yeah, here it is. It was picked up all over the place. It was an AP story. Kentucky.com had it. Charleston Gazette had it. Here's one from New York Newsday. Dateline Atlantic City, New Jersey. If wind power were fully developed off the East Coast, windmills could generate enough electricity to replace most, if not all, the coal-fired power plants in the United States, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said Monday. The coal industry group said, those numbers are overly optimistic. This was a speech given at a public hearing in Atlantic City on how the nation's offshore areas can be tapped to meet America's energy needs. Ken Salazar's quote is, the idea that wind energy has the potential to replace most of our coal-burning power today is a very real possibility. It is not technology that is pie in the sky. It is here and now.
Just ask them over in Holland. They know that.
But see, then he had to back off. By Monday evening, a spokesman for Salazar was saying that the secretary does not expect wind power to be fully developed. He was just speaking of its total potential if it was.
Well, what a useless pile of crap that is. Why don't you stick to your guns, folks?
Now, you know how we've been talking about numbers that are really hard to get your head around? This is a number that I think is kind of fun to try to get your head around. Salazar said ocean winds along the East Coast can generate 1 million megawatts of power, roughly the equivalent of 3,000 medium-sized coal-fired power plants, or nearly five times the number of coal power plants now operating in the U.S.
I'm just going to accept his figures. I can't get my head around that either. I don't know what 1 million megawatts is. How many high-definition TVs will that keep running?
Apparently that'll keep five times as many. but then, of course, out there to make sure that we don't step boldly into that bold future that you're talking about, where all we have to worry about are the Klingons and the Borgs. We have to worry about the Klingons before we worried about the Borgs. Actually, it's Klingons, Romulans, Borgs. We do have our problems down the road. There's Jason Hayes. Now, you know, this is another one of those ironic moments, Reverbo.
You're not supposed to be funny. This is serious stuff.
Yeah. Jason Hayes is a spokesman for the American Coal Council. You know, if I was the guy hiring the spokesman for the American Coal Council, I don't care how good he is, I wouldn't hire a guy whose last name was Hayes. Nor would I hire a guy whose last name was Smog or Fog or Acid Rain. Jason Hayes.
Jason Sludge.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. No, we can't hire Jason Sludge either. Jason Selenium does not get a job.
No.
But Jason Hayes did. Jason Hayes said he was puzzled. I'm Jason Hayes. I'm a spokesman for the American Coal Council, and I'm puzzled. Wind power plants face roadblocks like local opposition and concerns about their impact on wildlife and problems in efficiently transmitting power from far, far, far offshore.
Oh, all those problems that the coal industry doesn't face, Jason?
And then he went on. And this part is a quote. Jason Hayes. It really is a stretch. I mean, how you put that many new wind plants up, especially in deep water, is confusing. I'm confused. Even if you could do what he said, you still need to deal with the fact that the best wind plants generate power about 30% of the time. There's got to be something to back that up. Never mind the fact that the best coal, when burned, it's of all its potential energy, it only about 30% of the coal reaches the power grid. This is confusing to Bob Kincaid.
Well, you know, fossils confuse them too. They think that Satan put fossils on the earth to confound us. I wonder if Jason is aware that, I don't know, we actually visited the moon once, or that we've figured out a way to, conquer tuberculosis.
Yeah, I don't want to confuse Jason Hayes any more, Reverbo. But not only did we visit the moon once, we've put robots on Mars.
I'm going to suggest that the only reason, you know this too, I've heard Ken Salazar speech before. I'm old enough to have heard this for 40 years. And you've heard this too. We've heard the same crap over and over. The only reason the future is not here now, the hell with that. The only reason the future didn't arrive 30 years ago is simply because the power elite doesn't give a shit what happens to this planet.
You got a strong brief on that one, Reverbo. You really do. I mean, in Susan's phone call, I was talking about, you know, my generation only looks back and wonders what of our world would be different. The generation that saw Kennedy die has a strong sense of what they lost. But by the same token, my generation grew up watching first-run episodes of The Jetsons.
Me too.
And I fully expected to be riding in George's car by now.
I'm not going to talk about the helium-powered pants. We've talked about
it. Right, exactly.
We're just going to wait. We have our order in. Look, when we came back from the moon, we were ready. God damn it. We were ready. And except we don't count. See? Because otherwise, it would have been here. The only thing that they care about, they don't even give a shit what happens like 3 months from now, let alone 300 years from now. All they care about is just how many steak dinners and hookers and golf trips they can squeeze in before they croak. And I'm just, for one, sick of it.
Oh, I know. And here, we were talking about the numbers, and you said you couldn't get your head around it. Look at it this way. New Jersey. By 2020, it will triple the amount of wind power it uses. By tripling its wind power, it will go to 3,000 megawatts. Okay? Now, remember, the off the Atlantic seaboard wind could account for 1 million megawatts. That's 1 million watts. I guess, what would that be if...
that's 1,000.
Well, I'm trying to think of hard drives, like...
1 million, like a terabyte.
1,000 gigabytes is a terabyte. So, a gig.
New Jersey is just a drop in the bucket.
Right, right. But it's also very, very highly populated. Never mind my failed attempt at mathematics there. Or conversions.
Yeah,
but anyway, in 2020, when New Jersey is getting 3,000 megawatts of wind power, that's 13% of its total energy consumption. So New Jersey could be handled totally by, let's see, 3,000, let's just round down to 10%. 30,000 megawatts would take care of Jersey. Out of, what did Ken Salazar say? 1 million megawatts?
Man, there's enough to go around, ain't there?
Yeah. And
well,
and this bit, you know, I love this business from our buddy Jason Hayes. How do you put that many new wind plants up, especially in deep water? I don't know. Call the oil industry. They've been putting great big damn oil rigs in that deep of water for a while now. You know, get the engineers at MIT on this. You know, the certified smart guys. And ask them, can you build me a wind turbine especially made to be even more efficient in a Class 4 hurricane?
But gee, how am I going to get from here to Kansas City? Well, Jason, you could, like, roll yourself down the highway and get there that way, or you could maybe just buy a used car. I know it's confusing. It puts some people on it. This is just a typical...
Like our buddy Kate is forever saying, I'll get a man on it.
I mean, not only is the guy's name Jason Hayes, but it's... I don't know why this is... If this wasn't so... pathetic, it would be funny. Once again, it's the straw man coming out, and once again, it's just the trying to exploit and encourage idiots. People who are going, yeah, man, how the heck are they going to get those wind turbines?
Did you ever see the late, great Phil Hartman on Saturday Night Live playing Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer?
Remember that one, but it sounds good.
He's a lawyer he's a caveman who's been unfrozen and becomes a lawyer, and he's forever standing in front of the court saying, I just unfrozen caveman lawyer, I not understand your complex television. You know, unfrozen caveman coal spokesman.
Yeah, there he is. Yeah, they just like took him out of his little chamber and yeah, it's just of all the people. Yeah, they got to just trot somebody like that out. Yeah.
Why didn't he just say instead of the pathetic attempt that he made? Why didn't coal spokesman Jason Hayes just say the Dolphins are going to be pissed? You know, because you know that's the big thing. Well, you know, the little birdies will fly into the windmills. Well, they fly into the grill of my car, but we're still making cars.
Yeah, they're going for the too big to fail. They're hoping they can get on that list, and so far they've been successful. But we will.
We cannot build windmills on the Atlantic continental shelf. It will completely eliminate the flying fish population. Did you know that flying fish can fly three stories into the air? Yeah, because after all, that's where these windmill blades are. From wherever they're set, from whatever surface they, from the surface of whatever, the blades are 30 stories up.
Oh, I can't wait for the future to get here. I'm just worried that there's going to be all these people. If we don't stop the people problem, all this crap that we talked about is still tied to oil. Fertilizer's tied to oil. Oh, these people, everybody's hungry, right? We have chicken farms and pig farms. Trust me, where I live, we got a lot of pig farms.
Oh, well, yes, you do.
They smell like gas stations. I mean, they are.
But see, if you get really serious about thinking about hydrocarbons and oil and gas and coal and so forth, well, the first thing you have to do is write off coal. Because, you know, the liquid coal boondoggle, just yesterday, this delegate from Hancock County who is a former covert ops guy from Iraq, from the Air Force, held a secret clean energy summit that featured executives from banks, the military, and, of course, the coal companies. His purpose was to hustle liquid coal. Now, it takes 3-4 gallons of clean, fresh water to create a gallon of liquid coal, and then the clean, fresh water you've used is no longer clean, fresh water. It's toxic waste.
Mm-hmm.
But this goonie thinks that that's the future. But, you know, coal is not a part of anybody's energy portfolio in the future.
But we've got
some oil. We've got some natural gas to deal with. And that's what, and that's, you know, there's this whole cycle or symbiotic system or whatever you want to call it, where we have to think about where we want to use the oil most. I think we've reached a point where maybe we're coming around to the notion that using oil to fuel our daily sitting in traffic commutes that, you know, L.A., you know, what, a 10-mile trip takes 3 hours in some place. Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, just burning oil to sit there on the freeway is sort of a stupid use. So we have to think in terms of how do we want to use the oil the best. And as far as coal is concerned, there really is no replacement that I'm aware of for metallurgical coal to be turned into coke to be used in blast furnaces to make the steel of various and sundry grades.
Well, there you go. Nobody's got a problem with that.
I would think we want to hang on to it for those purposes if we want to have steel in our brave new world.
Well, you know, we used to run cars. Cars were originally designed to run on alcohol, like corn alcohol. Like everybody.
Well, Professor Diesel designed his engine for farm machinery.
Well, I'm guessing
that we're going to be run on, you know, biodiesel. Biodiesel's not a new thing.
Well, and just guess the name of that guy. And you're going to guess this. I know you are because he's the name that's near and dear to your heart. And guess the guy who was behind the what is it called, the Volstead Act, behind Prohibition. He made everybody think that it was because of we want to, you know, it's immoral to just be drinking whiskey all the time. When in fact he wanted to put a lid on the alcohol production so that he could sell us gasoline.
Oh, that wouldn't be a Rockefeller, would it?
I'm not touching that. I'm not going there.
Yeah, okay.
You can guess that if you want.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Seriously, we got to think about how we want to use the coal. We got to think about how we want to use the oil. We got to think about how we want to use the gas. I mean, my God, think about the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, Reverbo. Think about the downhill slalom. And how those really competent skiers go shoosh, shoosh, and they're going, and they're, you know, zigzagging around those gates, and even they can't keep from hitting the gates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you remember a few years back we were all concerned because Saddam Hussein was going to get in a blow-up rubber raft all Yossarian-like, and he was going to paddle his nuclear device all the way to the shores of the United States and then blow it up?
I remember something like that.
Yeah. So if you've got along the eastern seaboard a whole bunch of wind turbines that are by design staggered, you know, so that they're not just all in a line, so that they're staggered so that they can make maximum use of the wind, then isn't anybody on like a little Zodiac rubber raft with an Evinrude on the back of it and a suitcase nuke in the middle of it? Isn't it going to become highly unlikely that they're going to be able to shoot through all those windmills and actually, you know, wind up hitting Hilton Head Island?
Or, in fact, shutting us down completely because you can't get them all, can you?
No.
Yeah.
And you know, coal spokesman Jason Hayes says, well, the wind only blows part of the time. I am willing to bet. I'm willing to bet that if the wind is not blowing off of Cape Cod, that the wind is damn sure blowing off of Savannah, Georgia.
I was just at the beach today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, rub it in.
hey, okay, I should, I'll rub it in. It was about 70 at the beach, and guess what? People were flying kites. Just about every time I've ever been at the beach, Bob, people were flying kites.
Well, we're talking possum country. We're talking North Carolina. I seem to remember these brothers from Ohio who heard about the really cool winds down your way.
The Satriano brothers?
No. No, they were bicycle makers.
Bicycle makers.
And they had a and they had this bicycle that had a gas engine on it and wings.
They needed a windy place to try this thing out on.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, but they did.
And they went.
You know, I got a great place for them. Yeah. I just thought of the place. It's on the Outer Banks. It's right off the coast of the United States.
Catville. Cat Kitty Eagle. Kitty Hawk.
Kitty Hawk? Yeah, I don't know how far Jason and the coal industry is going to get with this this attempt, but good luck to them. The trouble is ignorance, as usual. People turn on the light. They connect light with coal. As long as unless you bust that and break that, I don't know. I would connect bad teeth and being sick with coal, not being able to breathe. I don't know why that's not connected.
Well, you know, we've still the coal companies in West Virginia are still engaged in, and we're talking, you know, nigh 100 years now. The coal companies in West Virginia are still making the argument that coal does not cause black lung disease.
No.
I wish I was joking.
You told me that this idea that it creates all these jobs that's a dead idea too. There aren't blowing up the tops of mountains doesn't employ very many people.
No, it really doesn't. But you know what? Building windmills does. And that's the thing. You know, the Jason, coal spokesman Jason Hayes' comment that, well, you know, the wind doesn't always blow. It always blows somewhere in America. It's always windy in America somewhere. And as a consequence, you know, all we're talking about here is taking some of those really, really smart people that get paid to just sit around and think about stuff. At MIT, Caltech, Georgia Tech, you know, that crowd.
Yeah.
Get them thinking about how you design a grid that, I don't know, that compensates for the wind not blowing somewhere.
You could even get, I bet, one of those, I don't know, seniors for their senior project. They've already... I think it was 29 years ago, came up with a diagram and a fully functional automobile that gets like 300 miles per gallon. Whatever.
Because, you know, whether it's MIT or Podunk State,
get those guys.
Free pitcher of beer to the first guy to come up with it still gets a lot of results.
What do you think would happen if, and I'm being serious because it's not that I want to dismantle capitalism. It's just that I don't understand why they're so resistant to just, look, folks, there's money in this. There's jobs and money, and there's people who are going to invest in your company, and they're still going to buy your stock, and it's still going to be, you're still going to have a blast. It's just you're going to do something good for a change. What do you suppose would happen if one of these guys, who's the name of that Massey or the guy from Phillips Petroleum or Exxon, they just say, you know, that's it. In other words, they do a Ted Turner. You remember when Ted Turner was going to colorize all those Hollywood movies until finally enough people said, you know, you are just ruining this. You're ruining the whole experience. Quit doing this. And to Turner's credit, he said, you know, you're right. I'm not going to do this anymore. And he quit colorizing of old black and white movies. Well, what do you suppose would happen if the CEO said, you know, we're going to get on board with this. We're going to phase out all this dirty stuff, and we're going to get on board with making life better for everybody. Why is that such a bizarre concept?
I wish I knew. I mean, I can't even say it. If I'm the head of some energy company, if I'm the head of BP or, you know, pick one. If I'm the head of Exxon, and Chevron, any of them. If I'm that guy or woman, I'm thinking, you know what? It costs us next to nothing to do this. Let's get into industrial scale wind. Let's get into solar. Because even if, especially if you're an executive of one of those outfits, you know better than anybody else that you are dealing with a finite resource.
Well, now we're back to they don't care what happens 3 years from now. But I'm just, my scenario is that somebody starts to freaking care and sees some dollar bills in this.
Under the capitalist structure, the guy who goes out and gets rich on this, it's all, Sutter's Mill, California? It's all who finds the gold first. Or maybe it's not. It's, because we've pointed out, there's gold in that bar wind. But nobody out there, there's plenty of European companies that have. And there's Japanese companies that are.
Oh, what were you talking about? How you're going to plant those windmills in the water. There are people right now that have fully working concepts to put those giant mirrors in the middle of Arizona. I mean, this really can. And yes, it's true that the sun is free and the wind is free, but the solar panels aren't free, and the turbine blades aren't free. You still have to put people to work. You still have to build companies to do this.
And you still have to maintain them. You still have to repair them. Windmills don't have a perpetual life.
Of course not. You still have to tell people.
You've got a maintenance schedule. You have spikes in employment. Even something like, and by saying even, I'm not diminishing it by any stretch of the imagination, the Coal River Wind Project, okay? The Coal River Wind Project puts a humongous number of members of the building trades to work putting the windmills up. And then even after the thing's fully functioning, somewhere between 35 and 50 people are required forever to keep it going. And then there's the people, the little stores that spring up for the guys going to work, and little lunch counters and, apprenticeship programs for young electricians. And it's truly one of those, it's a big rock that makes a big ripple in the pond.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what? Yeah. I think I mentioned it toward the end of the show last night. There was a very simple resolution. It didn't have the force of law. It was just a resolution, Reverbo. And it was introduced in the West Virginia House of Delegates. It got killed in committee yesterday. All it said was, we support the idea of the Coal River Wind Project. And the coal industry, and the hopping up and down bellhop uniform wearing monkey bats, killed it. Killed it dead. Why?
Well, I don't know. Then I can't wait for the day when then they can miss that. They can get left behind. And they're not that we can look for nothing out of them. So I hope that their industry goes bust one day.
The thing is, it's going bust right now. The history of Appalachia is a history of boom and bust economic cycles around coal. And for 100 flipping years, Reverbo, nobody has been able to come up with something that ameliorates that boom and bust cycle. I mean, the little town that I live near is very nearly a ghost town that grew up around the coal extraction industry. There are real live, honest to God, dig around in the weeds and you'll find the foundations of entire towns, ghost towns, all over southern West Virginia. You know why they're ghost towns? They're ghost towns because when the coal played out, the coal company packs up, the coal company leaves and says, fend for yourselves now. A wind farm isn't going to do that. A wind farm is nurturing of its local community.
Yeah. That's true. That's very true. Until the earth gets so close to the sun that we all just broil, we should have sunlight and wind. That's a long time. You're almost describing what it was like in Colorado when the It's another same thing, another mine, just a different product.
Silver.
And gold.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing that happened in the mountains in Colorado.
And then lo and behold, and the same thing, it is a model. Because lo and behold, the silver played out, but the ski slopes were there. And suddenly skiing became very cheechy.
Sure.
And the next thing you know, you got all kinds of people showing up to go skiing. And then, boom, Telluride, boom, Vail, boom, Aspen. And well, the last I checked, those are not like broke-down, broke-ass, poverty-stricken company towns anymore.
They had their problems, but your point's well taken.
Yeah. Well,
also they didn't blow off the tops of those mountains, so they were available for skiing.
Right. we don't really have the snow, we don't have the climate, but you can damn sure hike, you can whitewater raft, you can hunt, you can fish. This place could be a sports. Oh, who's got that? No, Louisiana's already got that on their damn tag. This place could be a sportsman's paradise.
Well, same, it goes back to the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, I don't want to lose the Appalachians, and I don't want to lose the Chesapeake Bay. I don't, I want to save it all. But, man, we just got to do something about these people and all their high-definition TVs and their cheap.
And we got to do something about the Jason Hayeses.
And the Jason, well, I think.
Well, I'm confused.
Get him on your show.
Wouldn't happen in a million years.
I'm gonna
wouldn't invite him, but no, he wouldn't come on because can you imagine the conversation, Reverbo? Come on, Jason. I understand you're confused by the idea of whether or not we could put windmills offshore.
Right.
Can you explain to me what's confusing about that?
Well, I mean, you just put him on there for just a. You wouldn't know that those people never know they're being mocked and ridiculed ever. They always miss that. I want to leave you with this. I have a question. This is a Jeopardy question for everyone. Nature is self-sustaining, right? Nature is recycles itself. Nature it recreates itself on Earth. It's almost infinite for every critter except one. Can you guess which one that is?
I'll take human beings for 500, Alex.
You're going to go on to the bonus round. That's it. Well, make it personal, my friend.
Make it personal, Reverbo. Take care, brother.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye now. That's our critic at large. Reverbo. Always fun sitting down to the table with Reverbo because there's going to be a lot of ideas. You know, all that talk about what the world could be versus what the world is just brings this to mind. Can't resist. You know I'll never pass up a chance to play Donald Fagen.
What a glorious time to be free. What a beautiful. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's Thursday, April 9th, 2009.
Electro cyber attack. No salmon for California. No black cars. Plus, where there's a will, there's a smackdown.
George Will Smackdown, that is. Welcome aboard, Huffington Post Green. This is your Green News Report. Okay, I'm eager to get to the smackdown of everyone's favorite climate denialist flat earther, George Will. But first, here's Desi Doyen with some headlines.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that national security officials say they've been tracking cyber attacks on the nation's electricity grid. The hackers are believed to be from China and Russia because of the sophistication of their techniques, and they've penetrated the computers that manage the electrical grid, water, sewage, and other infrastructures, leaving behind surreptitious software, also known as malware. The officials who spoke anonymously say there's no evidence of damage or an actual attack on the grid or infrastructures, and the Obama administration is in the midst of a cybersecurity review, which should be completed next week.
No evidence of an attack, but evidence that they have access, that they have gotten in.
And
this,
they've left
grid.
Behind little cookies for us to find later, and that's, of course, not sure that we found all of them.
Oh, man. All right.
Indeed. California Fish and Wildlife officials have closed the commercial salmon fishing season for the second year in a row due to a record decline in fish population returns. The decision will also effectively close Oregon's commercial salmon fishing season as well, but Washington State should be able to go forward. The California Air Resources Board caused a bit of a stir last week when it appeared to some bloggers that they might be voting to ban black cars. This is because black paint makes a car's interior hotter, requires therefore more intensive use of air conditioning, which is a drag on fuel efficiency. But it really was just a big misunderstanding. The California Air Resources Board was basically trying to look for a more reflective paint that would absorb 20% less sunshine, but they found that hasn't been invented yet.
And who were these bloggers who thought that California was going to ban black cars?
Well, of course, most of them were auto bloggers, and the ones that are not necessarily on board with the idea of climate change, we're against the idea of government interference.
So these weren't progressives. These were perhaps some of the denialists that we like talking about and trying to come out with new things to
be mad
about,
to complain about the government involvement in. But again, it was all just a big misunderstanding.
So black cars are fine.
Black cars are fine. They weren't going anywhere. They never were going anywhere.
Speaking of black cars, I saw recently that Volkswagen is coming out with a $600 car.
We'll have to see.
Year?
It's a concept car, so we'll see if they're actually able to make it commercially.
That gets some 285 miles to the gallon.
We'll see if it actually comes out. This does
You're
bring
dubious?
Us. I'm not quite dubious. I would say it depends on if it's commercially scalable and if they're actually able to get it out there.
Well, Volkswagen did it before in the 60s, and watch them do it again while the American automakers sit around and do nothing.
Speaking of cars, yesterday at the New York Auto Show, nearly bankrupt Chrysler unveiled only one new car model, and of course it was an SUV.
Not a $600, 285-mile-per-gallon car?
No. It's the newly redesigned Jeep Grand Cherokee, and they're proud because it gets 11% better gas mileage before, now at a whopping 20 miles per gallon.
Oh, man. This is their new car?
This is their only new car at the New York Auto Show. Now, contrast,
tone deaf much?
Contrast that with the announcement from Razor Technologies, which is a startup company in Utah, that they're going to debut an SUV that gets 100 miles per gallon. It's a full-size demonstration SUV, would be designated as an extended-range electric vehicle with a range of 40 miles per charge in all-electric mode.
As with my commentary last week on Tesla, I say that the White House needs to get in there and make Detroit build those cars by those other companies.
Yes. Now, remember, several weeks ago when Washington Post columnist George Will wrote that factually incorrect column, desperately and deliberately misusing statistics on Arctic ice.
Said there was more ice now than ever. Something
right.
Along those lines.
And he completely misused statistics from an Arctic research organization that complained.
He was making it up.
He was totally making it up. Now,
right.
Will is getting smacked around in the pages of his own newspaper. New research shows that we're starting this spring with the lowest Arctic sea ice on record. And reporters at the Post were writing about this, and they actually named Will directly in their article. Quote, they say, the new evidence, including satellite data, shows a significant decline from the 1980s and contradicts data cited in widely circulated reports by Washington Post columnist George F. Will that sea ice in the Arctic is not significantly declined.
Well, and this is great, because the Washington Post had previously backed him up on that column, didn't they?
They had. They didn't. They basically had their ombudsman come out and say, well, you know, the science is still under controversy, which, of course, it wasn't. And they didn't acknowledge that the researchers themselves called them and said, this is not a correct interpretation. But then later,
the researchers who he was citing
right.
called and complained, and Washington Post didn't care.
Right.
And now the news side says, we do care, Will was wrong.
A month later, the Washington Post did create a sort of, not really an apology, they didn't apologize, but they did actually try to say, well, you know, they're, okay, so we might have goofed on that a little bit, but now they're actually coming out in the paper and saying so.
Good for them, finally. And what are they going to do about George Will? Is he going to apologize?
I doubt it.
I doubt it, too. How about fire them? There's an idea. Let's fire all the liars. I'm just saying. Okay, read about that and much more in Green News Extra at greennews.bradblog.com. We also want to welcome aboard our new partner affiliate, Huffington Post Green. Hey, guys, drop us a line, greennews@bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yeah, well, okay, it's more like tonight's final half hour. It's about 27 minutes past. Being me, Bob Kincaid, I refuse to be constrained by such things as clocks. If Jason Hayes of the American Coal Association can be confused by something as prosaic as a windmill, I can tell the clock to go stuff it. So there's about, 30 minutes or so of conversation left in tonight's program. Jump right in if you want to. There are a couple of things that I think that they're mentioning here as we roll toward the end of the program. Because some of this stuff's been kind of heavy. We had a couple of giggles with Reverbo. I love lightening things up a little bit because I am forever bringing Reverbo down. And I don't mean to bring people down. It's just when you're dealing with wing nuts, well, sometimes you can laugh at them. Sometimes you can get a giggle like we did last night. Sometimes you can get a giggle from, things like the voice of Jesus for
the American Family Association. No, not the American Family Association. The Voice of Jesus from Focus on the Family getting popped for soliciting what he thought was a 15-year-old kid in a chat room and then going to meet said 15-year-old kid. And of course, Focus on the Family's press release that says we're shocked. Shocked. Huh. Yeah, you should be. You were shocked about Ted Haggard, too, but who's counting? It is fun to have a giggle or two, but the other side of the dark side of the wingnuts are how murderous, eliminationist, and utterly poisonous they are. You know, the Michelle Bachmann's Lock and Load, Minnesota. Jesus Christ. Lock and Load, Minnesota. There, that's the right voice. So I'm glad we could have a giggle or two. And Jason Hayes can't make this stuff up. A guy working for the Coal Association named Hayes. It's not Wednesday anymore, but it is never improper to note that God is a God of irony, especially during Holy Week. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Hey, Dave, what's happening, man?
Well, I'm back to listening. Life's been insane for a little while.
Life does that.
Sorry?
Life does that.
Oh, I know. Coming at me from all sides right now. But anyway, don't want to bore you with that lot. Just listening and watching the world fall to pieces. You're talking about the wind power thing and all of this stuff. And it's all really nice, and I really hope that people are waking up. I was just in the chat room saying that. And I think right now, Obama's been handed an impossible task, and I think the other side are standing off to one side and rubbing their hands because they know he can't fix what's going on. And then they can jump up and down and say, look, we told you he couldn't do it. But if they'd been in, they couldn't do it either. So I think it's kind of, I almost think that the other side threw the election.
I made that argument on a number of occasions throughout the election process itself, through the campaign process, I should say.
And
because
there's no surprise here.
I mean, can you for a moment? I mean, just even a moment, a scintilla euros of time. Can you imagine what would be happening? Well, first of all, there wouldn't be any stupid little tea parties going on if this was John McCain's filthy mess, because we'd already have a tax cut. And we'd be broker than we were in the first place, tax cut for the Wall Street banksters and so forth. And Fox News would be declaring that everything was sunshine and violence.
Oh, I know. I mean, it had to have, it's the best of two options. But, people have got to wake up now. If this lot that's going on right now doesn't wake people up, then just line up something to end it all when you need to, because it's so in your face. The corruption and criminality at the top is so in your face now that I don't know how stupid you'd have to be not to be angry right now. That really is kind of how I see it.
I'm angry. There's no doubt that I'm angry.
That's what I'm saying. I obviously realize that.
I'm not the kind of angry that shows up at these tea parties. Those people are out there. They're orbiting a separate planet, Dave. Because they,
all we need to do is change the priority from the first thought when anything happens being how much will it cost to how many people will it hurt. That's all it takes, simple as that. And the world's sorted out. That's it, I think.
Well, there's stuff that needs money spent on it, and there's stuff that doesn't need money spent on it. And
the priority issue, everything's about how much money, not how many people need.
Right,
and if we
right.
change that, then we're sorted out.
You know, our buddy Chris wrote in and had an email last night and said, you know, if I could do it, I'd just go and stand in front of the White House and say, you know, where's my stimulus? Where's my relief?
Yeah. Yep. If you did that, you'd be carted off somewhere and probably, shall we say, not treated very nicely, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, the Tea Party things are created by right wing, and being in Canada, you may not get as much coverage of this, but it's a completely phony phenomenon ginned up by right wing PR firms. And it's people saying, no, don't spend any money. We want to sink. We want America to die. When for the last 8 years, they had no tea parties when we were destroyed. I mean, you know, what we're looking at right now, Dave, is the outgrowth of 8 years of fiscal and monetary and budget policy by the Bush administration that includes things like off-the-book wars. I mean, it makes me absolutely crazy when I see a story.
If the taxman came after you and you said, well, I haven't got it on my books, would that go down very well?
No.
Well, then why not? If they can do it, why can't you?
Well, because, you know, as F. Scott Fitzgerald said, the rich are very different from you and me.
Right. I asked the question to make a point.
Yes, it was rhetorical in nature.
Exactly. You know, I mean, this is the thing about all of it. That if you're up there and you've got plenty of, well, I wouldn't say plenty of folding stuff, but you've ripped off enough working people to have lots of zeros in your bank account, then you can be dishonest and corrupt and basically evil and just say, if you do get caught, just say, oops, sorry, can I give you the money back? And all's fine. But if you're desperate for food and you steal some from the store, you're a bad person.
Oh. Well,
you're probably desperate for food from the store.
You're not a bad person, you're a criminal.
Well, yeah, exactly. But the point being that the criminals who are running the place seem to think that just because they set up the law, they're not criminals. Well, they're criminals by any sensible measure. Way more criminal than somebody who says, I've got two kids when they've only got one on welfare. They're probably, how much would they steal in a year? A couple of $1,000? Where these banksters can steal a couple of $1,000 over while they're having a sip of their coffee. So who's a criminal here? You know, and I think the way things are going right now, the U.S. government is just ignoring criminality of a certain group of the population. Well, the rest of the population should say, well, if you can ignore their criminality, you can ignore mine too. And everyone should just go into the store and just take stuff, not pay for it, just take it. Because that's what the people who are running the place are doing.
Oh, no, well, see, that. But then, Dave, you run into that sort of black and white world that you had during Katrina, where there's a photograph of white people wading in water with some stuff on their shoulders, and it says, New Orleans residents, look for food.
Yeah.
And the other photo that shows the same thing, only it's dark-skinned people, looters steal.
Mm-hmm. But that's just the, you know, the propaganda machine at work, isn't it? You know, I don't know if you were in the chat room earlier, but obviously you're a bit busier than I am. I'm just listening. But during the miners' strike in the UK, I'm absolutely convinced that the destruction of communities was deliberate because the powers that be didn't want communities to exist that would help each other. They wanted all those people to be dependent on the corporate monster who could suck money out of them instead of people helping them because they needed help. And I really believe that was a deliberate destruction of community.
Oh, gosh.
That's another way that these things happen.
Well, sure. I mean, we see the same thing that goes on here.
I know.
The mountain removers come in, and the next thing you know, the State Board of Education says, well, you know, we need to consolidate the schools in that county. And community schools get shut down, so there's no community schools, so people move away, so the area's depopulated, and then the bombs really start going off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, it's everywhere. It's everywhere you're looking at. I find myself just wondering how a few people, there really is a few, comparatively speaking, have managed to take over to such an extent that the majority, the vast, absolutely enormous majority, can't seem to change anything. You know, it's logically bizarre. And really, it needs people on the street. The only thing that has ever changed things in history is people on the street. Look at what's happening in Europe right now. You know, in France, the French are really good at this. I mean, people criticize the French and say they're useless, but you know what? When it comes to protest, they're
pro. Oh, they're pros. They went, you know, they went pro in 1787, Dave.
I know. Yeah, the French have always been really good at protest. And, I don't know, the Brits aren't bad at it either. You know, I mean, when good old Maggie brought in the poll tax, a really neat thing that happened with that was, one of the things that was happening was when people refused to pay the poll tax, the bailiffs would come in and take their stuff. So some clever person got this idea together that if 40 people know one person who's paid the poll tax, so the bailiffs can't come after them, they sell their whole contents of their house to this person for £1 and get a receipt. And when the bailiffs come round, you say, you can't take this, it's not mine. Look, here's the receipt. This guy owns it, and he's paid the poll tax. Piss off. Pardon my French online there. But, you know, and I thought that was a really creative way of going at it. But the poll tax meant that my mum paid the same amount of tax for the fact that she exists as the Queen, which I thought was a bit off, you know. But it was an interesting approach to a problem. And eventually, the courts were so plugged up by the whole thing that they had to back off. And these are the kinds of methods that people need to start to use now. Just plug it all up. Just, you know, take the risk of, you know, having a record. But if you've got 2,000 people standing in front of a courtroom in a queue for the same offence, you're all off, aren't you? There's no way that anyone can go down that road. So I think, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way of becoming more active in this stuff than I am, and to try and get to more people. And I think that might be a nice way of doing it, you know, to try and get people to just protest in that way. I've got to do something. I can't watch this any longer. I mean, I've done as much as I can on the quiet, you know, trying to talk to people and get them to listen to stuff and open their eyes. And I've got a few people to kind of think a bit more. But, you know, it's so bad, we got to do something. I mean, what you're doing, I really kind of admire for what you're doing. You know, you're in there, you put it all on the line and online, and more power to you. And the more people you can get to listen to you, great. I've told lots of people about you. But, you know, time's tight. We got to change things real fast or we're done.
Well, we do, and the question, it's the eternal question, how? Because being liberals or progressives or whatever we prefer to call ourselves at the time.
I'm going to say it's just a label.
Yeah, they're just
people
labels.
People
but
who care.
But the thing is, we still have, with very few exceptions, we are still a largely segmented movement.
Yeah, and that's what we've got to change.
You know, because the gender equity people are still separate from the marriage equity people, are still separate from the environments, environmentalists are still separate from
that
labor.
Fracture.
Oh, yeah. Don't think that that isn't fostered.
I don't.
And I mean, there are some changes. I mean, I saw with that... Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference. That was a confluence of labor and environmentalists, and that's a very, very important beginning. but it's also understandable because there are so many people who feel like their particular issue is literally life-threatening. And you know what? They're right. I mean, among the gay community, people are still being beaten to death. People are still being murdered for how other people perceive that they live their lives. Not even the actual realities, but mere perceptions are sufficient cause for murder in this country. You know, look at that freak in Pittsburgh. There was no reality. There's no Obama's going to get your guns reality. It's a complete fictitious creation of the right wing for nothing more than ratings and the ability to charge more for advertisements for Vienna sausages, for Christ's sakes. And people are dying for it, Dave.
Yeah. I've said on many occasions to my children, I mean, they're teenagers now, so I can call kids really, but we're at the point now where we discuss important issues. And I say to them, there's only one divide on this planet. There are greedy people, and there are people who aren't.
Well, maybe I'm a little bit more Marxist than you. In that I believe there are two kinds of people on this planet. Them that work and them that don't.
And them that don't run the damn place, don't they?
Right. But the problem in that dichotomy, Dave, is getting people to understand, because, you know, you've got people that work. You've got workers who are making very nice salaries. There are workers out there who make $250,000, $500,000, $1 million a year.
And that's fine. I have no issue with that.
Right. But I just want them to understand that as long as...
they're actually creating something.
But right.
But
or
take a pile of money and move it from one drawer to another drawer, and you take 20 out while you're doing it, how can you end up with more?
Sure.
That's what the bankers seem to be able to do, though.
Right. But getting people who make decent money to understand that if someone is... If you're getting a paycheck and someone else's signature is on it, you're a worker, because you are then at that, at whoever it is mercy for your next paycheck and the next one and the next one and the next one.
Yep.
But there's an inherent snobbery that's enforced. It's another one of those created fractures. You know, somebody making $125,000 a year doesn't think he's got anything in common with a guy flipping burgers. He's better.
Well, yeah, I mean, this comes right down to the really, really basic stuff. And one of the things, I had an aunt who was handicapped, mentally handicapped, and that really has been a big force in my life. It led me to meet people with handicaps, and I have met some absolutely amazing and remarkable people who were handicapped. Some of the most amazing people I've met have been labeled by society as handicapped. And one of the things that, again, back to what you're saying, is that everybody has value. Everybody has a right to exist, and everybody has something to contribute if you're prepared to give them the chance to do so. And the people that are running the planet right now are the people who just want to suck the life out of everybody else.
Right. And see, the other side's objection with the scenario that you just described is that you said, if you just give them a chance. Well, the other side, oh, I don't have to give nobody nothing. See, that's them liberals. They want everybody to give a chance. I want people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Well, what if they ain't got any feet?
But the thing there is that all these people who say this were given a chance at some point, weren't they? Or else they wouldn't be where they are. So that argument's dead right there. It's really straightforward. I knew somebody in the UK. I don't want to kind of go on for too long, but there's a village in North Yorkshire called Botton Village, and the whole village is owned by, I think, a charity called the Camp Hill Village Trust. And I used to spend a lot of time there. It was a connection around my aunt's stuff. And I used to go up there and help out for probably a month a year, any chance I got, because it was an amazing place, great people. And there was a woman there who was deaf and dumb and mentally handicapped. You absolutely would be blown away if you gave her a glass and a grinding wheel. She could etch and grind and engrave glass like a wizard. Just unbelievable to watch. How the hell did anyone find that? And that place seemed to be able to find what people were good at, no matter what the level of function they had. You know? And it was a remarkable place. And the whole point is that everybody there had something to contribute. And that everybody does have, if you give them the chance. No? It's really straightforward stuff. And it's just greed that screwed everything up.
And don't forget bigotry.
Well, that's just an extension of greed, really. It's about control. It's about I'm better than you. And greed's all about better than you. It's all about I need this because that makes me better than you. That's really the driver there, I think. I don't understand it, to be honest. But that's what I think the driver has to be. The need for superiority, which almost guarantees the fact that they're actually inferior, these people.
Right. Well, the need for superiority is born from, you know, the need for superiority is born from innate sensations of inferiority.
Exactly, yeah. And it's only people who are kind of okay with themselves who can really look at it all. Because the people that are running it right now are all like that. And right now, they're all scared, hopeless, that everyone's going to wake up. Because if everybody wakes up, they're really deep doo-doo, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
So they're going to really have to keep Fox News on the go.
And that's why Fox has gone where Fox has gone. It's no longer enough to simply argue that all the liberals are out to get you. Now they have to argue specifics. They have to, and that's the problem with any con like this. Every so often you have to ramp up the con, and they are approaching very, very dangerous territory, Dave. I mean they are. I started out the program, and I hate even talking about it. But they're a gnat's whisker from advocating armed revolution.
Yeah. Now, for me, revolution might not be a bad plan, but it needs to be nonviolent. Because violence is...
Well, but then, you know, for your average Fox viewer, then all the fun's gone out of it.
Well, I know that. I'm trying to talk sense here, not Fox. You know? I mean, for me, non-violence has been scientifically proven to work better than violence.
But nothing goes bang.
Well, you could. You know, when everything was sorted out, you could set off a whole shitload of fireworks to celebrate. So then loads of things could go bang. So you could have everything figured out and still watch a bunch of things go bang. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
No, not really. I mean, to go back to that French Revolution argument, you know, there was a lot of people having a lot of fun at the start of that, until Dr. Guillotine's little toy started getting used on them. Robespierre was having the time of his life until he turned into an enemy of the state, and that's the way wingnuts are here in this country.
This is the problem with humans. The very last people who should ever be given power are the people who want it. And that's really that. That's what that is, isn't it? You know, if everything turns to rat poop, there's going to be a few people who are going to want power and jump up and try and use it to get to increase their own power.
Well, some of that may just stem from our primate nature. But
isn't it time we kind of got to a point, I mean,
where we were attempting to rein in our primate nature? Oh, sure.
Yeah, we're trying to... humans claim to be so separate from the animal world. Well, if they want to be so separate from the damn animal world, then stop acting like them and start acting with logic and sense and you know, some reliance on evidence and not on, I'm looking for words here, on ignorance. You know, if you want to claim to be separate from the animals, then act it. If you can act like them, you can't claim to be separate from them. So, you know, take your pick.
Indeed. Got a roll, Dave. Good hearing from you. Sorry to know your life's in chaos, but...
Well, you know, one of those, isn't it? We all go, as I've said to my kids, you know, there's the road of life. Some sections of it have more potholes.
Exactly. And some portion of it is always under construction.
Yeah. Well, I'm just in a nasty bit right now, but we'll be all right. We'll get through the other side, I think. Anyway, good talking to you.
Hang
good
tight, Dave.
Doing, and keep doing it.
All right.
Good night.
We'll do. Later. Canada correspondent Dave. Indeed. On the road of life, some part of it is always under construction. So, our giggle for... No. Save that for tomorrow. We'll just call it quits. No, wait, we won't. This belonged on prayer meeting, but it didn't quite make it last night, because I only got it today. This is, of course, what the Christian world calls Holy Week. Tomorrow will be, no, I guess yesterday was Ash Wednesday, and tomorrow's Funky Friday, or Freaky Friday, I don't know. But you probably didn't know, but there is apparently a war on Easter. Yes, yes, yes. Agnes will be crucifying a little chocolate bunny on Sunday. War on Easter. Some right-wing blatherscape says, what is really interesting and not a little disturbing is the Obama administration's outreach to the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered groups. They are filling the White House Easter egg roll with gay families. This is an insult to Christians everywhere. Turning the most holy of days in the Christian calendar into a gala celebrating sin. No kidding. Liberalism has sought to remove culpability, remove personal responsibility from all acts, thus making any behavior clean. I guess they missed the whole Wall Street thing, because that's their side. Never mind. You know, mote, I, beam, other brothers, I, right. Yeah. Yeah, the... Right wing, right, war on Easter. Die, Easter egg, die. Liberals do not believe in eternal truths. They believe that everyone wanders around in their own reality. No, we all live in one reality. That's the problem. You people believe that Easter bunnies lay eggs. And this guy's got the nerve to talk about liberals walking around in their own reality. Dear Lord. So that is it. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll be here tomorrow for Freaky Friday or whatever it is on the Holy Week calendar. It's been a fun week so far. Thank you for your phone calls. Thank you for your conversations, your ideas, your emails, your participation in the chat room. Don't forget to check out the headonradionetwork.com/forum. David from Maine is posting a lot of cool stuff there. Well worth you taking time to check it out. Thanks to everybody for stepping up and trying to keep things going here. We will, Lord willing, get the chat room paid for here pretty quick. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional, to John Fox, our chief engineer, chief musician, webmaster, man about town for all he does. Thanks to Ben Birch, the most overworked man in liberal talk. WhiteRoseSociety.org, I mentioned at the top of the show. I'll mention it at the bottom as well. Ben is in rather desperate need of a new, rather expensive computer. Your help in that direction is always appreciated. Thanks to the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Standing up every day and fighting way upstream for all of us, because we are indeed all downstream. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.